Thank you, Hugues, for the introduction and to the Collège de France for the invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. I must say it was also quite intimidating preparing this this lecture because of the stature of François Jacob, and also because I looked a little bit at François Jacob and ecosystems, and it was difficult to find how to link the two. So I'm really glad Edith had a similar inspiration to me and used a painting from Le Douanier Rousseau, because in our imaginary, and I would argue perhaps in François Jacob's, this is what we see when we think of ecosystems, or this is what we think of. There is one occurrence in François Jacob's work where he does mention not ecosystems per se, but at least ecology. I'm sorry, I didn't translate the French for the Collège de France, but basically in English he says biology is not really unified, and on the one side you have what we would call evolutionary ecology. I have a pointer. So which he calls an approach to be integrist or evolutionist, or evolutionary. And then there is the, and he uses the word ecology, ecology. And then on the other side, there's the reductionist biology, which nowadays we would call molecular biology, which he contributed to found in a way. So he's opposing the two, and he's still aware that at some point you need to understand higher levels of organization. And so he's aware that this molecular biology, you can have emerging properties at some point. And so what I would like to do today is perhaps go a little bit even further and see how we could try and reconcile these two biologies. And I will tell you later also the second reasons for choosing this painting. Two of the reasons which I think make ecosystems relevant to the François Jacob's approach, one of them is that there's a long-standing tradition in reductionism also in ecology. I will go quickly on this, but I couldn't resist showing some equations. These are some very, in fact, some argue this is the work by Lotka is also the seminal work to the founding of the notion of ecosystems. And Lotka had a very reductionist approach. He thought, well, in an environment, you have preys. Let's say x of t is the number of preys at time t. You have predators, and y of t is the number of predators. On the left-hand side, this tells you how these populations vary. And so preys, they give birth to new preys, and then they die from predation. You can see the product between prey and predators here. And predators, they change through predation. When they eat preys, there are new predators being produced, and then they die. This is obviously extremely simplistic, but it's been inspiring, and nowadays there's still lots of people working on these equations from a mathematical standpoint, but also from an applied point of view, trying to find the oscillations that the system predicts in nature. So that would be one of the reasons. And in fact, still quoting François Jacob, he was really open to theory. He was in this quote in the Logique du Vivant, he says, you need theory because without theory, some observations might just be uninterpretable because you don't have the framework to interpret them. He then quotes Pasteur, which you could argue is strange because Pasteur is one of the researchers who showed you can work without theory. He was really an empirically driven researcher. Anyway, so the second reason, for which I think is why we are talking about ecosystems also today, is through the revolution that has come through microbial ecology. We saw this morning with Chris Bauer's talk, with sequencing, we can now access the DNA and describe ecosystems or whole communities. There are a whole range of the living that are known only through their DNA, like the Loci Archaeota. These are known through their DNA only. And Even further, it's really the human microbiome that has really made this bridge, I think, between the ecology in the field and the molecular biology in the lab. I have a beautiful quote from Theobald Smith showing that these approaches are not that new, but in the interest of time, I will skip on this to focus on one type of microbiota, which is the vaginal microbiota. So this is the second reason for choosing this painting. It's also something I didn't know, but Le Douanier Rousseau didn't travel at all. He painted, this painting is called The Dream, and it's also an illustration that you don't need to go very far to find original ecosystems. And to me, it's really surprising how little is done on the vaginal microbiota compared to the gut microbiota, for instance. Jacques Ravel at University of Maryland is really one of the experts on this topic, but you can see the papers are really recent. Because there's of course a public health importance of understanding the vaginal microbiota, but also from the conceptual point of view, I think the vaginal microbiota is a beautiful study system, because contrarily to the gut microbiota, for instance, it's much less diverse. So in the gut microbiota, to make things extremely simplistic, a healthy gut microbiota is extremely diverse, and a dysbiotic gut microbiota has low diversity. With the vaginal microbiota, it's the opposite. So it's Jacques Ravel has shown you have five main community. CST stands for community state types. And four of these communities are strongly dominated by one species of lactobacillus, gram-positive bacteria. One of these communities is slightly different. It's colonized by anaerobic bacteria. It's very diverse. So this one is a bit of an outlier. But yes, it's a system really interesting to understand the microbiota, and it can be studied at different scales. At an evolutionary time scale, these lactobacilli-dominated communities are really human-specific. You don't find them in other mammals. You don't even find them in non-human primates. There's also variation throughout life. There's a big change at puberty with estrogens, where at puberty you have more or less an anaerobic vaginal microbiota, and then it switches to this lactobacillus-dominated microbiota. There are, of course, monthly variations with the menstrual cycle, and there are even daily variations, if you want, with perturbations. So it's a beautiful study system. But today, the idea was to talk more about ecosystems, so I'm not going to talk a lot about bacteria, but more about the rest of the ecosystem. So the ecosystem, as Edith introduced, is the species that inhabit an environment. So here you would have what belongs to humans, so human cells, immune cells, you could even put antibodies into the picture. There are some fungi, not a lot of diversity, except when there are infections. And then, of course, the viruses. We find bacteriophages that are not really well known. And then polyomaviruses and papillomaviruses. And so today it's going to be more about these papillomaviruses, HPVs. So these papillomaviruses, you probably heard of them because they're the most oncogenic viruses known to humans. They cause all cervical cancers, several bunch of other cancers. There is a vaccine now. There are several vaccines that are safe, efficient. The vaccine coverage in France is appalling, but in some countries it's really good. But here I wanted to talk about HPVs more in an ecosystem context and more less on the pathogen side, but rather on the commensal side. And something few people know is that most of the infections caused by papillomaviruses do not cause cancer for sure, but they even don't cause chronic infection. So if you take 100 infections, this is by HPV-16, by 3 years, you see that more than 90% of these infections will have regressed naturally. So some of these become chronic, and even among the chronic ones, they regress. And of course, in biology, a lot of the funding and the research is driven by pathology. So we know much more about what happens in these cases here when there's cancer. We know virtually nothing about these asymptomatic infections, even though they are the vast majorities of the infection. And so this is what we were interested in studying. To do this, well, following François Jacob's plead for theory, we developed a mathematical model. And so we abstracted the life cycle of these papillomaviruses. So the life cycle goes that way. Papillomaviruses, they need to infect basal cells of the epithelial layer, so stem cells. And then, contrarily to other viruses, they're not lytic, so they will live with the cell. So the cells mature. When the basal cell divides, it produces a differentiated cell and another basal cell. And the infected cells will migrate towards the surface, carrying viruses, and when the cell dies naturally, the virions are released. So we try to capture this by basically breaking the epithelium into several life stages of the cell: basal, parabasal, keratinocytes, dead keratinocytes. I'm showing the equations, but I won't go through the equations, but it's really very similar to the predator-prey model I introduced before. You have the stages going from basal cells, parabasal, etc. You have the free virions, so you see it on the flow diagram here, how the cells age and release free virions that can then infect new basal cells. And you also see something where you could make a parallel with a predator, although I would argue that the interesting thing is that it doesn't behave like a predator, but we have immune effectors, and these immune effectors will kill infected cells. So you find some parallels with ecology. So what did we do with this? Well, this model is still simple. We have very few parameters. We could get some of these parameters from the literature. There's some data on how long it takes for a parabasal cell to differentiate, for instance. We also collaborated with a, I'm sorry, I forgot to put their names, but Robert Jackson and Ingeborg Zeber at Thunder Bay University. And they did raft cultures, so three-dimensional cell cultures, which helped us parameterize our model for the growth of the various various cells. Although they use a cell lineage that produces a keratinized epithelium, so it's slightly different. But the idea is that we estimated model parameters, and then we wanted to try and explain why some papillomaviruses will cause warts and others will tend to cause lesions or cancers, because there are hundreds of human papillomaviruses types, and the ones that cause cancer, the high risk, they almost never cause warts, and the ones that cause warts, the low risk, never cause cancer. There is some of the molecular biology that is known. So we know, for instance, that all papillomaviruses, both the low risk and the high risk, they can turn back the differentiated cells back into S phase. So this is through an action of the oncogenes that will bind P133, and there is no feedback because usually this is driven by growth hormones. And for high risk, there's something even more, which is that through the E6 oncoprotein, for instance, there will be a degradation of P53, and this will lead to increased proliferation of the infected cells. So we know there are some differences, and this is what we ended up, well, we succeeded in doing, was generating infections that look more like a wart, a condyloma, or more like a lesion. So here, this is time going on the x-axis. The infection starts here. These are our four layers. The basal layer remains constant, and the shading shows the proportions of cells that are infected. And so you can see that there's more shading, so there's more virus, but there's also a growth of the epithelium due to this proliferation, and then clearance, and then you're back to homeostasis. And then with a high-risk-like infection, you get less of a wart and a much longer infection. And what we show with the mathematical model is that the most parsimonious way to generate these two different patterns, using, of course, the known biological values, is to play with the burst size, which is the number of virions that are released by an infected cell. So in a way, we can make predictions based on our mathematical model by setting some parameters which are known and varying the ones that are unknown. And this also generates patterns in terms of virus load. Here, the red lines are how the virus load would change at the surface. You can again see the difference between the low risk and the high risk. And this is the activation of the immune effectors, which you could interpret as CD8 cells. For instance. So this is all very nice, but of course it's a mathematical model. Would it be possible to test this? So that's what we've been doing in Montpellier now since 2016. So we've set up a clinical study where we enrolled young women. There's 150 women enrolled from 18 to 25. And we follow them regularly. So they come to the clinic and there's a gynecological exam. If they're infected by HPV, they come back every 2 months until they clear the infection. And if they're HPV negative, they come back every 4 months. And if they become infected, they switch to the HPV positive arm. Now I think we're still following 30 women and they're all infected. This is perhaps one of the most important slides in the talk, because some people say, you know, the ones who talk the more are the ones who do the less work. So here are the ones who are actually doing the work. The team in the lab, they are actually about to start, because we have the visits on the Monday. So they will start the visits in an hour, and then the sample processing will end around 8 or 9 p.m. It's really a heavy study. So Vanina, Soraya, Sophie and Massilva are all working in the lab or in the field. And then Christian Selinger is doing the data analysis. And then we have midwives for the consults, nurses, and then other colleagues for the advising on lots of aspects. We collect lots of samples. I will not have time to go into a lot of details, but just to give you an idea, during these visits, we measure vaginal pH. We collect swabs to look at the microbiota to extract the DNA. We use ophthalmic sponges to collect vaginal secretions. This is to look at cytokines, so the immune response. And then we have cervical smears. These are used to do a cytology to detect whether there are potentially cancerous lesions, or to count immune cells using flow cytometry, which is a nightmare, and also to measure virus load. We collect blood. We want to look at human genetics. We want to look at HPV antibodies, sorry. And we would like to do some immunophenotyping. We, of course, detect for other STIs. And we collect a lot of information, metadata on behavior. This is, so I'm going to show a little bit the results related to HPV. This is what the results sort of look like with HPV. So here, these are 20 participants. So each box is a participant. On the x-axis, it's the number of days of follow-up. So you can see that some of them we followed for 800 days. When there's a line, it means that an HPV was detected in this woman at a given time point. And when the line is thick, is that it was detected at this time. So for instance, for our first patient, you can see when she was enrolled, we detected HPV 31 and 51, and then she cleared both. So we have some, this one with this much longer infection. Then we have some patterns that are more diverse. One of the main results here, which was reassuring for us, is that we had a lot of consistency in the patterns. We were really afraid that in the same women, we would find HPV 66, HPV 16, HPV 18 with a change every 2 months. Here we do have a lot of consistency. And of course, this is just presence-absence. So what we did then was to set up qPCRs to try and quantify the amount of viruses. So this is a really fresh slide, but it was really reassuring for us to see this, because it means it makes sense biologically. So again, here each box is a participant. The colors indicate the HPVs we find in this participant. And the y-axis is the number of HPV copies we find per keratinocyte, so per cell. We normalize the number of viruses. You can see that the y-axis are hugely different between participants. In this one, the number of copies is 30,000 per cell. In this one, we have less than one copy per cell, so we have a lot of variation in the number of viruses we find. But what you also see is that the pattern here is not a mechanistic model. It's just a spline going through the points. So it's more to visualize the pattern. But what you see is that in a lot of these participants, when we have a sufficiently long follow-up, we see this exponential increase, and then followed by an exponential decrease. So typical of an acute infection that you would describe in many infections. So for us, it was really reassuring. You also see that sometimes when we detect a lot of HPVs, like in this participant here, well, one of the HPVs seemed to be dominating. Here, HPV 53 seems to be really the one driving it, and a little bit HPV 56, but HPV 35 is negligible. And so it seems very simple and very intuitive, but this has never been reported for papillomaviruses. So all we had now were studies of chronic infections with one or two time points per year. So here it's really a beautiful pattern. And we are collecting the antibodies. I was hoping to show you the antibody profile, but our collaborators at the DKFZ in Heidelberg are struggling with admin issues. It's not just France struggling with administration. So hopefully we will be able to combine this to the immune response. And ideally, our hypothesis is that this clearance here will perhaps correlate with an increase in antibodies, but this is really unknown. So I've just presented a very tiny bit of this environment, really the papillomaviruses and a little bit the human cells. We are collecting data on the microbiota, on the bacteria and the fungi. We are collecting much more data on the immunity, so the FACS data is still being processed, the cytokine data is collected, but only for the inclusion, the data is collected only at inclusion so far, and the antibodies is collected and is analyzed. Actually, it's just the quality control that's missing. So we really hope to be able to link the mathematical models I've shown to this kind of data. And of course, about ecosystems. Ecosystem is not just the living, the biotic compartment, it's also the abiotic. And so our hope would be to be able to link things like pH, for instance, or perturbations like antibiotic treatment or probiotic treatment with some of these patterns. And to finish, and coming back to François Jacob, one of the ideas he was expressing in the first quote I gave and in the end of his book he names this integrans. It's the idea that when you move to an upper level, there are emerging properties. This is something that is really well known in epidemiology. So in epidemiology, patients infect each other, but what's happening inside a patient is really going to shape the epidemiology. So these within-host dynamics are really shaping the epidemiology. And what I find particularly interesting is when there's this feedback loop, which is that sometimes what happens at the upper level can affect the dynamics at the lower level. And in our case, you might wonder, because when we started this clinical study, the ethics committee, their question was, well, why are you doing this? You know, these women, they're perfectly healthy. This is just a waste of good money. Why study this? Of course, there's the fundamental research motivation. But if we move to an evolutionary standpoint, currently the HPV vaccines are being implemented. And one of the things we know is that any public health policy exerts a selective pressure. It's particularly clear for antibiotics. If you use antibiotics, you will select for resistance. So we know that by vaccinating, we're exerting a selective pressure on the viral population. So the question is the virus going to evolve to this selective pressure and how? And just to show you, this is a pattern we didn't expect to find because our study is not designed to be run at the epidemiological level. It's really designed to be run at the within host level, but still, among our 150 women, we found a diversity of HPVs. They're ranked in order frequency. So HPV 53 is our most frequent HPV, and HPV 42 is the rarest. And this plot, what we show is whether we find the HPVs more in vaccinated or non-vaccinated women. We have roughly half and half vaccinated, non-vaccinated. On the middle line, you have HPVs that are found both equally in vaccinated and non-vaccinated. On the right-hand side, these are HPVs that are found only in vaccinated women. If you're here, for instance, HPV 44, we only found it in vaccinated women. The color code gives you the p-value, so it's not entirely significant. We see on the other side, these are the ones we don't find in vaccinated women. You see that HPV 16 is really not found in vaccinated women, which is expected because the vaccine is targeting HPV 16. But HPV 51 is never found in vaccinated women. And this is a big surprise because it's not in the vaccine cocktail. It's consistent with earlier results, but this is just an illustration that the vaccination is acting on the diversity of HPV. And this is really evolution. When you change the frequency of genotypes you see in a population, you have evolution going on. So our hope is that by better understanding what's happening inside the host, we can basically move on to higher levels of dynamics. And I will conclude by thanking the team working and also all the advisors. This project would have crashed several times by now had all these people not accepted to share their expertise. So I'll be happy to answer questions, and thank you for your attention.